G'day. That's right. It's that time again. Time for cinema. Yes, welcome back, Cinema Eugen Kent Hill. Thank you for listening to us on Spotify or wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts. Today, my friend and collaborator Sean Ellis, a screenwriter and director who has worked in the film and television production industry since 1994. He began making films at age 11. He grew up in Sydney and Hong Kong, studied at the Film and Television Production and VCA School of Film and Television in Melbourne in 1993. Where he graduated, he has written feature screenplays in a variety of genres, including action, adventure, thriller, science fiction, and horror, as well as directing short films, commercials, and documentaries. In 2010, Sean's screenplay Claws was a finalist in the Beverly Hills Film Festival. And Sean produced and directed a documentary in 2017 on his alma mater in Hong Kong for the school's 50th anniversary. That was in 2017. And since then, he has been continuing to write screenplays and pitching screenplays and is even tutoring in a screenwriting diploma at the New York Film Academy in Australia on the Gold Coast. As he continues his mission, we're happy to have him on Cinema Eugen. Sean, welcome to the Eugen.
I'm doing well, Kent. How are you?
Good, mate. Good to have you aboard.
Thanks for the intro.
Yes. So you're a busy man. You've done quite a few things. The bio sort of sums it all up. But to talk a little bit about your into the beginnings, what films sort of influenced you coming out of the gate when you were young?
Well, growing up in the 70s, I sort of saw, you know, things like Star Wars and Close Encounters and Superman as a young child. And then, you know, I sort of got into heavily into Spielberg films in the 80s as I was sort of, you know, growing up. And I started making films about the age of 11 with a Super 8 camera. And so, yeah, the if you look at those films, you'll see a lot of stop motion, special effects and, you know, horror influences and a lot of Spielberg influences as well. So, yeah, I was obsessed with that stuff, and I still am. That stuff is still a very big influence on everything I do.
I remember a couple of years back, because it's sort of readily available on YouTube now, is that documentary about the making of The Empire Strikes Back, which was called FSPFX.
Yeah, yeah.
The making of The Empire Strikes Back. Now, that was, oddly enough, around the same time we must have caught that. And that, I mean, films blew my mind when I first saw films, but when I saw that and that people made films and you could do it for a living, that blew the back of my head off. That put the brains on the wall behind me, because I was
like, I completely agree. Yeah, I was the same for me. That was an event for me. And I remember the day that ran on TV, because I'd seen all the commercials leading up to it. And I remember, you know, scheduling my afternoon and my evening, like, I cannot miss this.
Yeah,
because, yeah, I'd seen the movie, of course, and The Empire Strikes Back was I was about 9 when I saw that, and yeah, remember everything about seeing it.
But that was one of the last movies I saw at the drive-in. It was the drive-in in Formal, where I come from. And that was one of the last movies, that and the Dino De Laurentiis produced King Kong.
Right. Yeah, I was going to the drive-ins around that time. It was definitely, there were still a few going in the early 80s in Melbourne and Sydney. So I was in Melbourne up until about 1981, and then we moved back to Sydney in 1981. So that's the thing. You remember where you see things, you know, at that age, because it's such a big deal. So, yeah, but no, The Empire Strikes Back was huge, and then Raiders of the Lost Ark was huge. And I remember seeing, I missed Close Encounters at the cinema, so I saw that I would have been 6. Like, I was taken to see Star Wars, but Close Encounters I wasn't. So I saw that on TV a few years later, and
right,
it just, you know, these things sort of fill in. They start filling in the picture of who a filmmaker is. So, you know, I really, really got, you know, I became very interested in directing because of Spielberg.
Sure.
And yeah, so it kind of, the Super 8, you know, and then I remember reading his biography, or it wasn't wasn't an autobiography. It was a biography that was one of the first published. And that was fascinating. And it only went up until, I think it came out in 83. So it was really only covering the beginning, the first maybe, you know, 15 years of his career.
Yes.
And but still, I mean, it showed me, it kind of gave me this impression that, you know, I could probably do this, or I felt a lot in common with his childhood, I suppose, you know. And so is that finding a role model is a big deal, you know, when you're starting out.
Totally. You've had many adventures in Hollywood, because it's suggested in the bio, you did spend some time, and you continue to spend time over there. In since we've known each other since 2016, you told me many great stories, and you hooked up with quite a lot of really great filmmakers. One of them was Nicholas Meyer. I remember you telling me a story. You wrote a letter or something to him, and were surprised to hear back and actually got to talk to Nicholas Meyer.
Yes, and so I was planning a trip over there in about 1996, and so well in advance of that, I wrote letters to well over 100 directors. I don't know how I did it, but I sort of, you know, basically asked, because I'd been working in a bookstore, and that bookstore had some great, you know, it had, like, in those days you could buy books that listed, you know, it was before the internet, so.
Yeah.
You would be able to find someone's representative. You'd be able to find, you know, their production office address. And so, you know, you had ways of contacting them. So I wrote letters and, you know, and sort of explained, look, I'm a recent film school graduate. I really just want to observe. I'm flying over from Australia. Cool. And so about four or five responded. Nicholas Meyer was one of them. Cool. And he was very graciously invited me to his home. And I remember sitting and talking to him for maybe half an hour, maybe an hour. I you know, the time becomes sort of, you know, hard to sort of.
It's inconsequential because you're sitting across from the guy who directed The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, but yeah.
It's solution.
And I was 24 at the time, so I was kind of still. And this was the whole point of the trip, was to really. I'd been to LA several times with the family on holidays, but this was a time I was going by myself. And as I say, having just finished film school, I had a new perspective and a new sort of interest in demystifying Hollywood and really, you know, figuring out what does it take and how hard is it really to get to these people. So I really got lucky. And as well as Nicholas Meyer, I met Simon Windsor, who had just directed The Phantom. He was amazing. He invited me to come along, and initially to come to one of the audio mixes they were doing.
Sure.
And yeah, at a sound stage, at a mixing stage in Hollywood. And so we turned up to the stage, and I've since learned it's one of the most, you know, historic mixing stages in Hollywood, is where Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark were mixed. The mixers said to him, well, actually, it was a technical thing. They thought they had to do different mixes, or the director thought they had to do different mixes for Dolby and DTS and all these other things. And at the time, they had a little powwow and talked about it. And he said, well, we don't need to do another mix. So we're going to go to Paramount and watch the movie with the executives. Do you want to come? And so I got in his car with him, and he drove me over to Paramount. And it was my first time, I think, visiting Paramount, and, you know, so I wasn't on the tour, but I was getting a personal introduction to it. Yeah, so sat there and watched The Phantom, and in a studio cinema. Yeah, great experiences.
Yeah, totally. So moving on to your actual filmmaking, you made short films and whatnot, but a project that was a long-term project for you was, as you say, and you were still completing this when we first met each other, and finished it around the time of COVID, was your documentary about the high school that you attended in Hong Kong.
That's right, yeah. So it was a real labor of love in the end, because, well, like most things turn out to be, because, you know, you sort of start off with an idea and you think, well, I guess I could do that in a year or two. But I'd heard that the school, so having partially grown up as a teenager in Hong Kong, we lived there for about 5 years. My dad's job took us there, and So I went to an international school, a British international school, and all the students were essentially, you know, from other countries, and their parents were there, you know, for work. And so it was a British school, so we're learning the British system. Yeah. And so the school was in 2014, I found out they were going to fairly soon demolish the buildings. And so at the time I sort of thought, well, gee, it'd be great to document it before it's knocked down because it's so historic. It meant so much to so many people.
And
I think through Facebook, I reconnected with so many people, as you do. And as you get a bit older, you think back and you get nostalgic about those experiences. And of course, this was a fairly unique school in a unique place at a unique time. So there was also going to be a 50th anniversary reunion. So I organized a crowdfunding campaign and raised money to rent cameras and took them over with me, and obviously got permission from the school. And I interviewed probably about a dozen teachers and another 15 or so former students, and did all that around the time and filmed the anniversary celebrations, and came back to Australia with probably like 10 hours of footage, and then started editing. And then, you know, in a way opportunistic, well, it was a perfect opportunity during COVID to really spend the time it would take to really cull this footage down and make it something watchable. And so I did, and I put it out as 5 segments, one on each decade of the school. And I'd already pre-sold it through the crowdfunding, but then I sold a number of other copies. It was really only geared or aimed at former students and staff. But there was an overwhelming response. It turned out really well. It was a great experience to just tell this story, because, you know, it had really had affected thousands of people. And you know, as I say, times have drastically changed in Hong Kong since those days. So I think it's a nice time capsule, very nostalgic, but it was just a good experience. You know, it's fun to just play around. I love editing. So
yeah,
it's an enjoyable experience, but very long. It took a long time.
Yeah.
It took 3 years.
On the subject of screenwriting, you have another long-term project that was that we mentioned in the intro, and that's The Legend of Yakutuch, which is a real passion project, another passion project of yours that has been long in the works and continues, right?
Yeah, for sure. And so that's something that, you know, I sort of really dove into screenwriting in the sort of late 90s, after a few years after film school. Well, obviously I'd written short films in film school and even in high school, but a few years after film school, I really thought, I really just want to start writing movies, and I don't know where to begin. So I sort of started, you know, reading lots of books and really teaching myself. And after that trip to the US, I came back and was really motivated to make that my focus, because it was something I could do on my own. And the film industry in Australia at the time was fairly, you know, it was small, and there weren't those foreign productions coming in. And so there wasn't much production work to be found. And so I thought, well, look, you know, what can I do without anyone else's, you know, money or permission? And screenwriting was the perfect, you know, solution. So I wrote a few screenplays, and then in the early 2000s, I sort of was sort of trying to get something made with a filmmaker who was primarily a cinematographer I'd worked with on a student film. Mm-hmm. And so we were trying to come up with an idea that was low budget, that we could film, that would be a bit on the exploitational side, sort of B-movie horror / sci-fi. And I kind of had an idea back then for an alien that crashed in near a ski resort and was, you know, hunting snowboarders. And so, but it evolved, and the story, as well as, you know, the terrible analogy I'm making. So the alien turned into a sort of an ancient creature, put it that way.
Right.
And then I started to, over the years, the script evolved and I turned it into more of a, I really realized it needed to be set in a very remote area where something could have lived for hundreds of years and not be discovered. And so I set it in the Yukon, in the Kluane National Park, one of the largest wilderness areas on Earth. It's fully protected and a sort of a UNESCO scientific place that you can only you can't hunt animals in there. It's just for preservation. So then I thought, well, I really need to bring in the First Nations and tie that into it. And so those were the sort of seeds of the story. And so after writing many drafts, whilst I was in LA for a few years between 2006 and 2011, and that's when I sort of interned and worked as a reader and did various things in on the development side. And so then when I came back to Australia, I sort of showed this script to a producer I'd worked with in Australia called Laura Sivis, and she optioned it. And so then we started developing it, and she would go to Cannes and pitched it to various people. And we were trying to get it made as an Australian-Canadian co-production and even trying to do it in 3D. So it was ambitious from the start. And since then, yeah, that option's expired. And, you know, I've kind of redeveloped it a little bit more, made it a little bit slightly smaller scale, really focused in on the Indigenous sort of First Nations history of the creature, which is all made up, but I wanted to make it feel as believable as possible.
Right, yeah.
So it's come a long way. At the moment, though, just to summarize, I mean, so I just got back from LA, and where I worked with a consultant to create a business plan for it.
Right.
And that was great experience, because he is someone who sort of developed the studio system, which is a sort of data gathering. I don't know how to explain it, but it's a software system that was developed and is used by all the major studios to track everything that's in release on all platforms. And it allows them to come up with very realistic comparables for the films they're making. So, and it's something that really only they've got access to, that independent filmmakers don't have access to, because it's $100,000 a month. And to use this software, and it's owned by Nielsen. So it's, and we're in an age of, you know, data gathering and, you know, this has become the norm. And but there was a way that I was able to use some of those comps that I worked with this consultant who was able to create a business plan. And that's part of my pitch that I'm working up to, you know, to approach producers with. And so it's exciting, because once you can sort of show an investor how a project might perform, and you've got actual data to back it up, it's much more sort of appealing proposition.
Yes, totally. As I mentioned throughout the interview, Sean and I met in around 2016, and we've been collaborating on a project which is at the moment titled Shadow Men, which is the story a story about a small town with a secret, isn't it? It's a man on a mission meets a small town with a secret.
Yes. Yeah. Along the lines of the X-Files or you know, John Carpenter always comes to mind. That was a big inspiration for that one. And yeah, so that's exciting. I mean, it's a fun project, and it's like, you know, I've always been someone who spends a lot of time developing things, because, you know, I always see things in different, you know, they do change over time. And I think that you're not going to always get it right the first time. You know, it's almost impossible to get it right the first time. And as a teacher, as a trainer assessor, I should say, that's the technical title for it, because I'm teaching a diploma. But that's one of the things that I'm always trying to drum in to the students, is that, you know, don't sort of just lock in on the first idea you get. It's got to be a bit loose and fast at first. You've got to be willing to attack it and question it and test it and throw it out if necessary.
That's true.
Because, you know, yeah, you don't.
And as you get deeper in it and you start to work with the directors, actors, producers, and whatnot, you have to be mercurial. In many senses, the script in its developmental stage has to be, in essence, a little bit mercurial, because as elements come and go, you find yourself having to retool it in many instances to suit budgets and people's wants and desires. Hey,
Yeah, I think that's a great point too, because that sort of makes me think of something I have learned over from working with a producer and pitching to lots of other producers and other, you know, executives and things online. And what really matters is that you've done the work yourself to test the story and find those plot holes. And really, you need to know why the characters are doing what they're doing. You need to know them like they're people. And if you don't, it's going to show, right? It's going to show in your pitch. You know, that experienced producer who reads hundreds of scripts a year is going to go, this doesn't work. You're not a professional, or you're not there yet. You know, the story's not there yet. And so I know what you mean about being, you know, you've got to be willing to say, well, we could approach it in a slightly different way, but you've also got to be able to defend it and say, well, we've tried that and this is what happens, you know, in the story. If you do that, or, you know, you can just always give an example sometimes of, you know, this is why the character's doing it, and this is why it's logical. And that can be very, you know, important to sort of prove that you have done the work, because, you know, it's obviously a lot of the student writers, when, you know, when they're starting out, they're quick to defend what they've come up with. But that's more pride in what they've done. You know, they're really just like, well, no, this is my idea. I don't want you telling me what to do.
Right.
And it's like, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm questioning why it's happening, and so will the audience.
So ultimately, you're going to be asked. You're going to say, well, why does the car have to be red?
Yeah, and the audience is going to too. If you develop something and you don't ask all those questions, and something isn't logical, then the audience will pick up on it, and they'll go, What's he doing that?
Yeah. Or, you know, if they can pick it apart too early, then chances are when it goes up on the screen, they'll rip it to pieces rather than just, you know.
Yeah, and it's not to say that, you know, a certain thing can't occur. You've got to bolster it. You've got to support it with logic, story logic, you know, or character logic. This is why the character's doing this ridiculous thing, because they, you know, whatever. There can be any number of reasons, but it's just, yeah, because you want to create realism within those 2 hours. It's got to feel real. And so the rules of the world have to be consistent and all those things. And I think that's partly why this script, Yakutovich, has taken so long, because it is a fanciful, you know, it's a fantasy within a realistic setting. And so for it to be believable, I mean, I get a lot of inspiration from An American Werewolf in London, which I find to be just, you know, it's a beautiful combination of tone of comedy and horror. But if it didn't have that sequence in The Slaughtered Lamb, where those characters are dead serious and they completely believe, and then after they leave, they're having this debate about, oh, we shouldn't have let them go, and, you know, and it's too late now. And, you know, that's what creates the realism for the rest of the film, because you've got, you know, these characters that are telling us, the audience, the rules of the story. Yes, there's a real werewolf out there, and these guys just don't know it yet. So, yeah, it's deceptively simple. I like stories and movies that are deceptively simple.
That's right. Some of the best ones are deceptively simple, like Jaws, Predator, all that type of stuff.
You bet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Alien. Yeah.
Speaking of film development, you've had some very recently, some good fortune. You got accepted into that. What is it called?
Just started the Untapped program with Australian Film. Yeah.
So what does that? Is that it gives you access to what?
So there's kind of a 4-month phase at the beginning, phase one, where so if you qualify for it, and, you know, which is it's a fairly elaborate application, but, you know, you just got to take your time and fill it out, and if you qualify, then you're essentially, you get to participate in these webinars that I've done. Yeah, they're sort of presented by Australian filmmakers who've become established in Hollywood and have, you know, kind of, and can teach you what they did. Yeah, yeah. And then in the second phase, they cull it down. They choose from that large group. They choose about 5 or 6 people, and they get individual mentorship for about 4 months.
Right, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So that's what we're all competing for.
Phase one, Yes, Sean Ellis has been my guest here on Cinema Yugen. We're going to put links to all of Sean's cool stuff in the description box. You can check him out at www.seanfrancisellis.com, and we'll put these links to that in his IMDb page. Check out Sean's cool stuff. He's got plenty of cool stuff coming and cool stuff that I'm working on with him. And Sean, mate, thank you for being on Cinema Yugen, and wish you all the best with all that, mate.
Thanks so much, Ken. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, really, really enjoyed it. And good luck with the rest of your podcast.
Awesome.
Got some amazing guests.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Sean Ellis. More power to you, Sean, my brother, my filmmaking brother. Yes, more power to him. And if you want to check out all of Sean's cool stuff that he has got going on, you can visit the www.seanfrancisellis.com. We shall drop a link to that in the description along with Sean's IMDb page. So please get over and check out all the awesomeness that Sean has going on. And again, thank you for supporting independent cinema. And thank you for listening to Cinema Yugen. I'm your host, Cant Hill. Thank you for tuning in on Spotify or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And we will catch you next time. See you then.